Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about President Obama's trip to Ghana in Africa. We'll be joined by Ni Akwete, who is a former Ghanaian citizen. He was the executive director of the Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and he created the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. And he'll be joining us in the first segment here coming up. And then we'll talk about recent revelations that former Vice President Dick Cheney instructed the CIA to keep a covert program secret from the Congress. We'll also look into the five Inspector General's report on the massive Bush program of surveillance, which apparently was both pervasive but also largely useless. And we'll talk with two distinguished legal scholars, Aziz Huck, professor at the University of Chicago School of Law, and Bruce Fine, a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran. And he was also has authored a number of volumes on the Supreme Court, and he helped write the articles of impeachment for Presidents Nixon and President Clinton. So he'll be those two distinguished legal scholars will be joining us to discuss that those two big breaking stories now. And then we'll talk about the climate energy bill that narrowly passed the House, now in the Senate, that some environmentalists have called a counterfeit climate bill. We'll be joined by Michael Oppenheimer, who is a professor of geoscience and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at the Department of Geoscience at Princeton University. He's also the director of the program in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy, STEP, at Princeton. I'm now joined by Ni Akwete, who is was formerly the executive director of the African Action Committee. He'll be joining us after a short, brief musical break.
Originally stepping out of Kenya, Africa, adopted into the cold woodlands of America. Trust me, Aya, them you defy every order, torn senator. Ratatatatata, the gunshot of hate continually echo in every corner. How come black man become president in a money maker? Barack Biwe, Barack Biwe, Barack Biwe. If I am turn your name into Barack Osama. Watch me now, in a desperate time, judgment will come without water. For legalizing abortion in America. A fire! Fire!
Mama, mama, come with me, Taco. Come with me, talk about Barack Obama. Papa.
And that is the anthem that's been playing in Africa, in particular in Ghana, for Barack Obama. And it serves to introduce Ni Akwete, who is formerly the executive director of the Africa Action in Washington, D.C. He is currently an independent African policy researcher exploring ways to increase the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy, and created the Democracy and Conflict Resolution Institute in Accra, Ghana, where he is originally from. He also has taught at Georgetown University and was an aide to Randall Robinson at TransAfrica during the U.S. anti-apartheid movement. And Ni Akwete, clearly that little refrain from a popular Ghanaian group, Black Rasta, indicates a certain jubilance. What was your impression of President Obama visiting your former country and the only stop he made in Africa?
Oh, I was like everybody else. Well, by the way, Ian, forgive me, I'm forgetting my manners. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, pleasure.
I was like everybody else. I'm very, very glad that he went. I am proud of Mr. Obama, but I know that you know, the entire world is in a line of people who like him. I'll be very, very far behind. So that's no news, but I'm so glad he went for a number of reasons. He has not yet completed his sixth month in office, and yet he made it a point to squeeze in a visit to sub-Saharan Africa. I think that is extremely significant. I'm sure that many of his staff told him, oh, you can't do this, there are other things, and he said, no, I am doing it. So I give him marks for that. You read his book. The first time he went to Africa was as he wasn't even a graduate student then. He was about to go to graduate school, and he went to Africa. So he experienced Africa without all the bubble around him as a president. So I think this is a great opportunity for Africa to have somebody in the White House who has focused on Africa and experienced Africa before he became a politician. And, of course, he has African blood in him, as he said. So for all of those reasons, I'm glad he went. I'm even more glad that he went to Ghana, not just because I am from Ghana. And, by the way, he went to the Cape Coast Castle, and I grew up in Accra and went to graduate school in Cape Coast. So the two places he visited are sort of my hunting ground, so I'm glad. But much more important than he's going to the country that I am from, I am glad he went, the reason he went. He went to highlight Ghana's democracy. In your kind introduction, I used to teach at Georgetown, and my view as a former professor, as an activist, is that the Africa has a lot of challenges. For me, the diagnosis is, why do we have these problems? We have them precisely because our democracy has been weak. And what is the solution? I think democracy. I don't think democracy is enough, but I think it is essential. I think without democracy, we cannot go anywhere. And I have a big fight with multilateral institutions like the IMF and the World Bank, because they take the view that forget about democracy, make your economy grow, and everything will be fine. We have been trying that for 50 years. George Bush talked about promoting democracy, but didn't do it. Mr. Obama hasn't talked about it, but he seems about to do it. So I'm elated that he went. In terms of Ghanaians themselves, as the song, you can see, the song is very catchy. It was written in the last month. The journalist who went with him said the whole country was very proud. So they were very happy to see him. I am happy he went. I'm happy for the reasons he went. He gave a great speech yesterday. Now the job is up to us to hold him to the speech that he made, to hold him to actually promoting democracy rather than just give one speech and then walk away from it. Democracy is what Africa needs, and he put it as his number one issue with regard to Africa. That is precisely why he went to Ghana, not Kenya, not Nigeria, not South Africa, but Ghana, because Ghana has been making democratic progress. So I am glad he went. Now, there were parts of his speech that, if I had written it for him, I would have not said some of the things he said, but overall, I'm happy.
Let me go through what you think he should have said as opposed to what he did say. One of the things that he did say, which I thought was kind of amusing, was a dig perhaps at Sarah Palin that Africa is not a country, it's a continent. But he also said that what Africa needs is strong institutions, not strong men.
Now that I agree with totally. I say amen to that, because strong institutions make up democracy. But you know, He threw out this point that a lot of people do throw out, that in the 60s, Ghana and the rest of Africa were behind. He used Kenya, actually, that Kenya was behind GDP in terms when compared to Korea. Now, that is a factual matter. That is true. But I think the damage that kind of assessment does is it gives no context. Okay? I mean, the Asian Tigers grew because the United States, once China became communist, once Mao Zedong took over, the Americans and the entire West decided that they were going to godfather Japan and the Southeast Asian countries so that they would grow. They gave them a lot of support and a lot of help economically and in building democratic institutions. That's how the Asian economies grew. They have never done that for Africa. In fact, in Africa, what the United States, France, Great Britain have always done is they have supported dictators, they have undermined African democracy. Even as we speak, as I mentioned, George Bush gave stirring speeches. His entire second inaugural was to say that America's foreign policy will be run to promote democracy. He talked a great game. He didn't do it. He supported Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia, who nobody will mistake for a Democrat. He supported Museveni in Uganda, who is not a Democrat. Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who is not a Democrat. Macias Nguema in Equatorial Guinea, who is not a Democrat. So the United States has a terrible habit of supporting African dictators, then turning around and blaming the African people and saying, oh, you guys tolerate dictators. Now, of course, to give America credit where it's due, they are not the worst. France is worse. Omar Bongo just died in Gabon. France supported him for 42 years. He has big money all stashed all over. They keep the dictators in power because the dictators open up their countries for foreigners to come and exploit it. Once again, I'm happy with Mr. Obama thus far. Mm-hmm. I'm happy he went to Ghana. I'm most happy that he is saying democracy is going to be our number one issue. Now, he has made a great speech. We have to make sure from now on, for me, my number one priority is to make sure he withdraws American support from people like Kagame, Museveni, Meles Zenawi, all of the dictators that the West supports.
Now, Nyakwetwe, there is also a new form of colonialism, if you will, in Africa. One is, of course, it's not new in the sense that you've had the missionaries in the past, but you have a kind of spiritual colonialism that's happening, particularly in Uganda, where Christian fundamentalists and the Pope both oppose condoms to stop the AIDS epidemic. That is so cruel and counterintuitive. You also have a tremendous number of investment now from China, who are trying to get rid of all these dollars they're holding, buying up resources. So there's a possibility that there'll be some new economic colonialism along with a kind of spiritual colonialism.
Oh, you are so right on both points. And Ian, I mean, this is a wonderful show. I hope you'll forgive me if I tell people. I mean, I did a long discussion on China's investment in Africa just a couple of days ago on Democracy Now. Folks can check it out. But the reason I say is the China issue is very important. I agree with you also on this spiritual colonialism, the religious colonialism that says, I mean, religion has put Africa in a very bad place. Bishop Tutu used to say that, you know, foreigners showed up and told us that we didn't worship correctly, and therefore they wanted us to teach us how to be Christians and teach us how to pray. We close our eyes. When we open our eyes, we had the Bible, they had the land. We ought to be very suspicious of colonialism, and you are right about that. Now, I worry even more about China's presence in Africa than I worry about the Western presence, because the Chinese don't have democracy in their own country.
And they're buying up resources like crazy.
Exactly.
and creating colonies that Africans can't even go near.
and if you look at what they do in their own country, Ian, this is what scares me. Any
right.
country that can kill its own people and take their property. I mean, we've had ethnic fighting in China, in with the Uyghurs in Western China right now as we speak. Hu Jintao left Italy to go back to China to crack down on that. The Chinese government will not know democracy if it fell over it. And so for us to turn Africa over into such people because they are bringing money, it seems to me we are forgetting our painful history. So I'm very skeptical of China's presence in Africa. Now, they bring technical knowledge, they build a lot of infrastructure, they bring money. I welcome those. But I'm saying we have to be very careful who we are dealing with, because it is not as bad as I say U.S. policy has been. You can speak out. I was born in Africa. I live in the United States now. I'm an activist. I have freedom to challenge American policies. I don't know of any foreigner living in China who can do that. And therefore, if the Chinese mess up in Africa, who's going to put pressure on them to clean up their mess? If the Americans do that, there are at least, by my calculation, about 3 million African immigrants now in the United States. I mean, your area, the Los Angeles area, is one of the biggest concentration of African immigrants, wonderful professionals. If we pool our talents together, we can improve United States policy towards Africa. And once again, my big bias is, if we can get the United States to stop supporting dictators, that will remove a big block on the road to democracy for Africa. Mr. Obama says Africa should emphasize democracy. I agree 110%. But the first thing we have to do is remove the power of the United States from the dictators, because they are the ones blocking democracy in Africa. I know that everybody knows about Zimbabwe and Mr. Mugabe. He, the United States, does not support. But the problem is that they don't talk about the dictators that they support.
So sure. When you mentioned them all earlier, and I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles at Nia Kwetwe. I'm sorry we don't have a lot of time here today with a lot of other issues to cover, but I'd like to get back to you and have a further conversation. Again, I thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'll be glad to come back anytime.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Nia Kwetwe, who's the former executive director of Africa Action. He is also created the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana, where he's from. And, of course, President Obama just visited Ghana. I'm now speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration. He was general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, research director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, the international law. He helped write the articles of impeachment for Presidents Nixon and President Clinton, and he's the author of a new book entitled Constitutional Peril, the Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy. And joining him is Aziz Haque, who is a professor at the University of Chicago School of Law. He was formerly directed the Liberty and National Security Project at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, and has worked with the International Crisis Group in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nepal on legal and constitutional reforms. He is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. And gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. And let me begin by talking. I want to talk about the report by the five inspectors general that just came out that suggested that the Bush administration had a massive surveillance program in the United States that was both huge and largely useless. But let's talk a little bit about, if we can, at the top here of the breaking story, how Vice President Cheney has been linked to the secrecy of a CIA program, in as much as he apparently ordered the CIA to keep a covert program secret. Beginning with you, Bruce Fine, do you think there's a real smoking gun here?
Well, we don't know what the specific program was, but in light of the Church Committee hearings in the 1970s, Congress did, for the first time, establish intelligence committees and place greater rigor in the oversight. And what they did in particular is they wanted advanced alertness to any covert action, and any significant planned intelligence activity has to be reported at least to what they call a gang of eight, the leadership in the House and the Senate and the ranking and minority members of the House and Senate intelligence committees. And if this was a direction by Cheney to flout the law, that I don't know what you call it, a smoking gun, in the sense that there's no criminal penalty attached for flouting this particular law, but it certainly shows the contempt that the administration had for Congress and its oversight, and also on the other side, the acquiescence of Congress, the lack of rigor in actually asking tough questions and not just assuming that anything that the CIA said was true. And that should have been apparent that kind of trust was not quite appropriate in light of the Church Committee hearings. There has to be suspicion in the House and Senate with this oversight if it's going to work at all. You just can't expect them to volunteer everything up when we know that the history of secrecy is the history of covering up embarrassment and illegalities. But certainly what this cries out for, Ian, is there's got to be some kind of formal body, and I think it should be a committee in Congress, that investigates this entire issue of executive branch disclosures and oversight of Congress by these kinds of very, very intrusive interrogation and surveillance methods, so we can have some confidence that there are checks and balances here. Say the whole reason, and I was involved in these Church Committee hearings that exposed 40 years of unchecked spying, was that it's inevitable when you give an intelligence agency the authority to operate in secrecy, there will be abuses, there will be overreaching. That's the nature of the beast. To a spy, just everything looks like a traitor. Just like to a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
And Aziz Haq, I mean, we know that the intelligence committees used to refer to the select, the intelligence agencies used to, briefers used to refer to the select intelligence committees as the mushroom farm. We keep them in the dark and occasionally throw manure on them. However, that is a different matter from the vice president instructing the CIA not to even inform the Congress about a covert program.
It's difficult to know how to fix a system that is broken in so many different places. And I think Bruce's comments bring this out. It's broken in the sense that the mechanisms for disclosure, mandatory disclosure from within the executive branch don't work. It's broken in the sense that even when things, when programs are disclosed to Congress, as we saw, for example, with the president's terrorism surveillance program that the Inspector General have written about, Congress does not act on them, doesn't always have the information or the incentives to act on them. And even when those programs do come to light and there is public discussion, often the response of Congress is quiescence and a failure to regulate. So when the terrorism surveillance program came to light, Congress's response was not to, as Bruce, I think, accurately identifies the need, was not to investigate. Congress's response was to authorize an even larger tranche of surveillance and to grant ex post immunity to private actors who collaborated with the illegal surveillance. So while the news about President Cheney's blocking is certainly troubling, and it's certainly consistent with other obstructions of fair and free information flow that we've heard, I don't think that it's a smoking gun in the sense either of criminal liability or of the helping us pin down what the key problem here is. The problems are much larger and more systemic.
Well,
yes, I would agree with that observation. To me, Ian, the most astonishing thing is you have this published report, it's not denied, and yet there's no chairman, there's no one in Congress that says, I'm going to have Mr. Cheney here tomorrow. He doesn't have executive privilege. He was a vice president. He's going to answer under oath what the hell happened. If it's got to be in executive session, it'll be in executive session. It'll be under oath, and he'll be here tomorrow. That is what would have happened at the time of Watergate and Nixon. If you got a disclosure like that, Alex Butterfield or John Dean, the tapes or whatever, that's what would have happened. And here, you know, what happens? Not a single member says anything. They read it in the newspaper like you and me and say, well, I guess I'm just an ink blot like anybody else and do nothing. And that's what makes this problem so alarming. Because if one branch of government has voluntarily surrendered its oversight responsibilities into the wilderness, it's hard to know what can you do to create a surrogate Congress to do the job.
Well, what do you think it is, Bruce Vine? Is it because they are compromised, because a whole number of these people on the congressional side, not just the big eight, were briefed?
Yes, I agree. It is because they are compromised, because they have done nothing for 8 years. One of the things that's disclosed in the unclassified version of the 5IG reports is that in March of 2004, the Gang of Eight, including Pelosi and Harmon and Daschle and Hastert and others, they were summoned in the Situation Room in the White House with Cheney, who gave them a briefing about what was going on with the, what I would call, illegal surveillance. And none of them said or did anything. Now, there's a footnote that says, well, two or three of them, Pelosi said, well, I disagree that we gave affirmative concurrence to what was doing. We raised a few eyebrows. But the fact is, every member of Congress knows that with whatever information they have, the Constitution endows them with absolute immunity to disclose any publicly important information on the floor of Congress in a committee, precisely because the Founding Fathers wanted the members to be robust and fearless and trying to expose executive branch or other wrongdoing. So they know they have this protection. If any one of them went on the floor of Congress and said, this is what's happening, it's illegal, this should not happen, we need to have the law changed, we need to have the law enforced, and not one of them did anything. They
of course,
for 8 years, and they know you have a hearing, they are going to be in peri delicto with the Cheney and the Bush.
Well, let's bring in Aziz Haq, because I'm wondering whether that would be political suicide in today's cautious, shall we say, political climate. Well, cowardly political climate might be more accurate.
That's absolutely right, Ian. Of course, as Bruce knows, what these members of Congress are worried about is not criminal sanctions, although those were waived in the general direction of the New York Times by Attorney General Gonzalez at one point. What they're worried about is political sanction. And at the back of this discussion has to be the question of why is it that the American people, the people who go to the polls, are not more incensed, are not more driven by the need to have some form of oversight here. And one of the very useful things about the Inspector General report is the way that it shows how the failure of process, the failure to have a reasoned, systemic, professionalized process subject to oversight and constraint when using the tremendous powers of the national security state, the failure to have that process leads to bad policy. One of the core findings of what was a very limited investigation, lacking in subpoena power, lacking in the capacity to investigate or even document the full range of quote-unquote other surveillance activities. So this very limited investigation nonetheless has brought out a very useful fact. And that fact is that the terrorism surveillance program that the New York Times disclosed in December 2005 was simply not effective. It was simply not yielding intelligence of an actionable form. Neither the FBI nor the CIA used intelligence that came from this extraordinarily expensive, by the way, extraordinarily expensive security program that violated federal law, that clearly risked many thousands of Americans' privacy interests. None of this yielded any actionable intelligence, and yet there were thousands of man-hours of time and effort, thousands or millions of dollars that went into this, and it did not render us an iota safer. Now, if this is the kind of program that unilateral national security programs hatched in the vice president's office yields, is this really what we want? Is this really the way we should be making national security policy? Isn't this something that Congress should be concerned about, not just because it's a violation of separation of powers, it's inconsistent with the constitutional framework, which I absolutely agree with, but it's making us less safe. It's diverting time, energy, and resources to the fancies of, for the large part, politicians. This is, remember, the brainchild of politicians, not national security professionals, in ways that are costing us time, effort, and money, and not making us any safer. Does this make any sort of sense?
Well, it certainly does, and I think what Bruce Fine said is that, you know, what is wrong with this branch of government, equal branch of government that has every obligation? They're supposed to be the people's house. They're supposed to be there for the people. They're supposed to step up to the plate and ask these questions and demand Cheney appear. Obviously, we don't know what this program, this secret program that he kept secret, that Cheney instructed the CIA to keep secret from the public, but the fact that there was so much secrecy in the Bush-Cheney administration leads one to assume that it was something pretty dreadful and something that perhaps explains Cheney's erratic behavior of late that he's concerned about. But I guess, Bruce, there's nothing more we can say about that before we go on to talk about the IG's report.
Well, it may well be it was something what you could call a plan to eliminate certain high leaders. You remember, this is not out of character of this agency. The CIA had for long years plotted the assassination of Castro, and they're involved in Lumumba. So these were disclosed at the Church Committee hearings, And there had been an executive order, you know, prohibiting assassinations. It may have been something like that, but I must say I'm just speculating on that score. But I want to come back to the idea of this kind of unchecked spying or surveillance authority making us less safe, because the executive branch doesn't scrutinize itself and say, hey, this is or isn't working. Politically, they said, just spy as much as you want. They never had any rigorous method of deciding, why in the hell are we doing this? We're not coming up with anything. The whole reason why you have a Congress there is to say, we want to know the results. If there was real oversight, and even assuming Congress let it go on, they'd say, but you report to me every week what the heck you're getting out of this. Because if we're getting nothing, you're squandering resources. And that's, I don't want the FBI and the CIA and NSA running down dry wells 100% of the time. We need to actually have a sensible way in which we have to allocate our resources. And that's why you need congressional oversight and check. The executive branch has herd instinct. I've served there. It's herds. Everyone just being an echo chamber of everybody else. And that's why it doesn't work when it acts unilaterally. And I just want to go back, and maybe this is a little bit of a stretch, but when you did not have any oversight up until the Church Committee and then the Intelligence Committees were formed, you had some real dumb things, like getting rid of Mossadegh in Iran. We're confronting that stupidity of the CIA in 1953 right now and looking at Ahmadinejad in Tehran. And this is the kind of thing that wouldn't invariably be scuttled if you had serious people in Congress asking questions, are you sure this is going to work? What are we doing? But I can guarantee you, if you don't have Congress asking those questions, the most idiotic ideas will be pursued, and it'll make us less safe. It's making us a more exposed country.
Well, let me turn that to Aziz Haq and ask you, Aziz, about this report by the five inspectors general now from Justice, NSA, CIA, DOD, and the Office of National Intelligence. Of course, I know, Bruce, you've read this report. It's a declassified report. There is a classified version, so we don't know that. What you just mentioned earlier, Aziz, is that they didn't have a subpoena power, but they interviewed, apparently, these five inspector generals, over 200 people, but they weren't. The main players refused to be questioned. They were Ashcroft, John Yoo, former CIA Director Tenet, White House Chief of Staff Andy Card, and David Addington, Vice President Cheney's right-hand guy, who apparently could personally decide who was read into this regime, in other words, who they could put surveillance on.
That's right. So the Inspector Generals are a statutory mechanism. They were created by a federal statute in the late 1970s as a way of creating some form of internal policing device. So everyone has seen the movies where there are internal affairs within the police department. It's the same idea, and they are supposed to be a way to generate information about activities going on within the federal government that may otherwise escape the attention of Congress. And Congress has used IGs across the spectrum of federal agencies and departments, particularly to focus on fraud, waste. For example, the IGs that have been focused on the Iraq war have identified an awful lot of fraud and waste that's gone on in relation to the rebuilding. And so these five IGs of the agencies that you mentioned have focused, and this, by the way, they have focused because they were required by statute to do so. The 2008 FISA Amendments Act required those inspector generals to undertake this investigation. And so what we're seeing here is this was the SOP given by Congress in that 2008 legislation to advocates who pushed for some form of accountability. But it's a very, very limited form of accountability. Most importantly, these five inspector generals did not have the power to subpoena information. So their ability to obtain a picture of what was going on was extremely limited. And because the number of people in fact read into the National Security Agency's TSP was very small, the fact that they interviewed 200 people is neither here nor there. Because they did not interview the key actors, and because they couldn't interview those actors under threat or under penalty of perjury, so that there was at least some security that the answers that one was getting were accurate, the picture that we have is necessarily going to be incomplete. Equally importantly, this investigation was limited to the program that the National Security Agency, that the New York Times revealed in December 2005, the so-called TSP. We know from accounts by people within the administration, like the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, that there were a whole set of other surveillance programs that were in the eyes of actual diehard conservatives within the Bush administration, people like Mr. Goldsmith, people like John Ashcroft, Jim Comey. These other surveillance programs were outright illegal, lacked any legal justification. There is no description, no account of those programs. Illegal in the eyes of people who were loyal civil servants within the Bush administration. No account of those programs in this report. So it's a very limited report. It's focused on one program that we know about, and you have to understand it as a part of an effort to cut short any other more substantive and realized investigations, either into this program or into the full gamut of activities, including whatever it is that the vice president shielded from Congress. And by the way, I have to be on the record. I have to say that I think Bruce has hit the most likely nail on the head. That this is that if I were to put my money anywhere, I would think that the program being hidden was a planned assassination program, although apparently one that was never put into operation. We have to assume that what the IGs have given us is a very, very limited perspective on what in fact happened, and that there is an awful lot more to find out, and that the Obama administration has really quite abjectly failed to flesh out the errors of what has happened, what happened over the past 8 years, and indeed is blocking efforts to invigorate the congressional investigative and oversight structures that might prevent those mistakes in the future. President Obama, for example, at the moment is threatening to veto the Intelligence Authorization Bill because it would expand the disclosure requirement from the so-called Gang of Eight, the leaders of the House and Senate and the Intelligence Committees, to the entire House and Senate Intelligence Committees, and have not been able to put forward any convincing justification of why revealing information to men and women who are sworn just as much to defend and protect the Constitution as the President is, people who are elected just as much by people within the United States as the President is, right, why there should be no disclosure to those members of the House and the Senate.
Well, let me bring back Bruce Fine. Bruce, I've learned about this secret program through the back door because the acting Attorney General Comey testified about it, the extent to which they tried to get Andy Card and Gonzalez tried to get Ashcroft to sign on his sick bed a reauthorization of whatever it was that they were doing, and it's taken us this long to find out what it was that they were doing. And the thing that I find extraordinary about this is that they circumvented the normal checks and balances by reaching deep into the Justice Department to one guy, John Yoo, to give them justification. And furthermore, it looks as if the reverse was happening. Instead of the CIA telling the government that we need to do X, Y, and Z, Addington in Cheney's office could say to the CIA, look, Al-Qaeda's coming after us, and you have to do this.
Well, yes, it's quite extraordinary, and I agree with you. This wasn't right after 9/11, the intelligence agents all running to the White House and saying, give us these powers. The White House saying, hey, would you have other additional powers that we can give you? And moreover, there is a portion of this unclassified report that suggests that with one, you know, every 45 days under this terrorist surveillance program, they had to be reauthorized based on a threat assessment that Al-Qaeda was about ready to perpetrate a second edition of 9/11. And that said that somebody at the White House came back after a threat assessment was submitted by the CIA and said, hey, this isn't good enough. Go back and make it more alarming in order to satisfy whatever threshold they thought they needed politically. But, Ian, I want to go to a larger issue here. It's not just, I think, the limited nature of the unclassified report and probably the classified that's disappointing. But the fact is, if we're going to have genuine reform, it's going to change the climate of all power in the executive. These hearings, they have to be public. This can't be done behind the scenes, executive session. It's got to be something like the church committee hearings. The American people have to know why the secrecy is bad, what it leads to, why it's not efficient government, why you do not have to give your game plan to Al-Qaeda in order to have checks and balances. They need to know it, and public education comes only with now televised hearings, open hearings. I remember in the church committee, everyone on the conservative side was saying, oh, the intelligence community will be destroyed. We'll never have any cooperation with any foreign intelligence agency again if you have the hearings. All of these wild Cassandran prophecies proved to be completely false. And with regard to these ideas, well, you can't go beyond the Gang of Eight because there'll be leaks out. Just think, where are all the leaks that have caused, you know, such great harm to the United States? It's very difficult to really discover any. I remember Jack Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, he said he wished the Congress knew and had leaked it out so he didn't make such a foolish decision. Now, that doesn't mean we want to be as foolish as give people game plans and knowledge of where we're attacking phones or whatever that are authorized under law. But there are ways in which you can use a sensible accommodation of the need for the public to know what their government is doing and what the dangers are that can make the system work. And I want to say this final point about, in my judgment, maybe the most important thing here. We're a democracy. And what made the United States unique for so many years is we get a thrill out of knowing what our government is doing, even if it helps the other side a little bit, because we can't conceal from the American public other people viewing abroad. But we govern our own destiny. We've got to come to grips with this decision as to how secret we want to be. Or do we want to engage in the kinds of abuses or in intrusive surveillances to try to prevent a 9/11? If so, what balance do we draw? We may make it wrong. We may have to change our minds. But it's the American people who are sovereign. We, the people, the first three words of the Constitution. We can't just give away this responsibility to other people. They will abuse it, and they will take it away, and we will turn into people like other countries which just sort of acquiesce in what Big Brother in the White House says is necessary in the name of national security.
Well, just in the last minute, gentlemen, both of you, a quick comment, if I can, on what's going to be going on next week. Aziz Haq, you clerked for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It seems to me that the whole debate about Supreme Court justices, I think this thing is going to be a bit of a non-event, because they're not putting up interesting and powerful and creative and strong people. There are no liberals on the Supreme Court. There are only centrists and ultra-conservatives. And it seems to me that the real dynamics are, in terms of choosing justices, are, you know, that the 4-5 break, but the conservatives that are on the poise to be a majority, they essentially, for all of the talk about judicial activism and original intent and all of those buzzwords, at the end of the day, they will vote for the powerful over the powerless, the rich over the poor, the connected over the alienated, the corporation over the employee, I mean, isn't that what's going on here?
Well, I think that there's part of that I agree with and part of that I don't agree with. I think you're certainly right to paint the kind of the right-wing cries or the right-wing rallying cries of originalism and sticking with the plain meaning of text and the like as inconsistently followed at best by those who invoke them. Most importantly, in cases involving race, we've seen the conservative majority on the Supreme Court strike out against remedial programs in a way that is utterly inconsistent with original understandings. Similarly, the Second Amendment decision last year is untethered from original understandings. And in both cases, I think that what we're really seeing is the product of movement politics, the product of powerful social movements, in one case led by the NRA, and in the other case the sort of the groundswell that started with the Goldwater campaign in the 60s, coming to intellectual fruition in the Supreme Court. And so I think that the best way of understanding the present Supreme Court is not in terms of a class analysis, or not in terms of the rich versus the poor, to use your phrase, but in terms of how the current set of justices on the conservative side embody the achievements of a very particular social movements who have focused on things like property rights, who focused on affirmative action, who focused on abortion, who focused on the Second Amendment. And so they are just as historically placed. They are just as much a product of a particular social time and political context as their liberal, as the people who they accuse of being unfaithful to the Constitution, the Justices Brennan and Warren of the past.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here. We've got somebody waiting here, and I have to move on. Bruce, I'm sorry. I'd like your comments as well, but we've run out of time. I know I did a bit of a bait and switch on you there at the end, but I thank both of you gentlemen.
I'll be on MSNBC tomorrow on Chris Matthews from 10 to 3 if your audience wants to get my views then.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. I thank both Bruce Fine, the constitutional lawyer, formerly served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration and helped write the articles of impeachment for Presidents Nixon and President Clinton, and Aziz Haq, professor at the University of Chicago Law School. I'm now speaking with Michael Oppenheimer, who is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Geosciences and International Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the Department of Geosciences at Princeton University. He's also the Director of the Program in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy, STEP, at the Woodrow Wilson School, and Faculty Associate of the Atmospheric and Ocean Sciences Program at Princeton's Environmental Institute and the Princeton Institute for International and Regional Studies. Michael Oppenheimer, clearly there is some contention now within the environmental movement following the passage of the Energy Climate Bill that narrowly passed the House by about 6 or 7 votes. And now in the Senate, some environmentalists, including Dr. James Hansen at NASA, have described the climate bill as a counterfeit climate bill.
Yeah, I think that's way over the top. The bill isn't perfect, but it will provide a good start on dealing with a very difficult problem, global warming. The bill is sometimes criticized on three fronts, and at least one of those is just flat out wrong. There's an argument that somehow the polluters are going to be given away the allowances or the right to pollute free, and this somehow destroys the regulatory strength of the regulation of the legislation. But that's not true. First of all, many of the free allowances given out are just going to redound as refunds or rebates to the general public in terms of, for instance, electric utility rate rebates. Secondly, giving away the permits, and some of them will be given away and some of them auctioned, has no effect whatever on the limitation on overall greenhouse gas emissions. It has no effect. It just has an effect on the distribution of funding or resources. So that's just a total misunderstanding and a false criticism. There is a criticism which perhaps has some validity, which is the so-called offsets, which are the ability to give credit for reductions which are not under the so-called cap. Those have to be watched carefully. If it's managed well, it could significantly reduce the cost of making greenhouse gas emissions reductions and therefore allow us to make more reductions, basically, than we have to. That's number one. But if it's done wrong, it could dilute the effect of the law. So that's will be EPA and the Department of Agriculture will need to watch those offsets carefully. There's a third complaint, which has some validity, but again, not all that much, and that's that EPA under this legislation would no longer have the ability to regulate greenhouse gases, something it's had since April 2007 under a Supreme Court decision. But there's a false analogy that's been made with the Clean Air Act. Under the Clean Air Act, EPA can tighten regulations continually, and you want that. What happens if somebody discovers a toxic air pollutant all of a sudden that causes cancer? You want EPA to be able to move quickly. But the greenhouse gas situation is different. There will be no immediate sudden bans of anything. It's something that plays out over decades, and over that time frame, it's perfectly appropriate for Congress to play an important role in the decisions. So I think some of these criticisms are simple misunderstandings. Some of them are misinterpretations. I think overall, the legislation is a good start on reducing greenhouse gas emissions will have an effect, mostly because it will send an important signal to consumers, to business, to everybody, that it's time to limit greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, because these emissions have no future. They're going to be going down.
Well, what about the... I noticed that President Obama met with the Australian Prime Minister at the G8 conference, and they announced the industrial nations were going to join a regime, but the emerging CO2 polluters, China and India and others, were not going to be part of that regime. There's another alternative as opposed to cap and trade, which a lot of people are worried that it has no provision to prevent insider trading by utilities and energy companies on a financial meltdown from speculators trading these permits and as derivatives. Just a straightforward carbon credit, which is an incentive for those who don't put up CO2.
There's a one facet of the legislation which would mitigate against the effects of speculation, and that is that there is a board appointed which acts like the Federal Reserve Board and holds extra permits and can buy and sell permits to stabilize the price. And this is a better deal than we get in any other regulatory regime where, you know, a company could have to buy scrubbers, for instance, and the price could shoot up because too many electric utilities are trying to control standard air pollution.
Right.
That doesn't have, there's no protection in standard pollution law for that kind of price change. So here we actually have some protection. As far as the separate issue of what happened at the summit, I think that there was false expectation created in the beginning, which was that somehow the G8 was going to agree on a major deal, a mega deal, which would have the developing countries all of a sudden agreeing to make big cuts. That was never going to happen. That can only happen in the context of the negotiations that are going on, that are expected hopefully to reach some sort of climax at Copenhagen. And really, no country is going to agree to do anything until the U.S. passes the law. Once the Senate has acted and Obama has signed the legislation, the world changes. And we will have, you'll see, both other developed countries like Canada, which has done nothing, and developing countries like India and China, which are getting interested in the proposition of doing something about emissions, finally starting to cooperate. But until we pass that law, nothing is possible.
And Michael Oppenheimer, by the way, there's a little bit of wind on your phone. If there's any way you can, I know you're in the great outdoors, get out of the wind.
I'm going to try to enjoy the environment on my vacation.
Right. If you can find a bear's nest or something.
I'm doing my best.
Obviously, the fate of the climate energy bill is in the Senate is not certain, and I understand the logic of starting a regime that can be improved, but you got to start somewhere. And that, of course, example of that was what happened with the CFCs, the ozone-depleting propellants that were eventually led to a global ban. They weren't perfect at first, but on the other hand, Michael Oppenheimer, what is wrong with a leader and a world leader like Obama? I mean, let me just put it in a very personal way. How do I look my 25-year-old daughter in the face and say, you know, the science out there suggests that if we don't really drastically reduce CO2, this planet is going to become unlivable, and there's evidence that massive amounts of methane will be released from the permafrost, that huge ice sheets will melt at the poles, and we may have a vast Sargasso Sea, not to mention having a lot of the land underwater and people scrabbling for high ground and shooting each other over a can of tuna. I mean, I'm not talking science fiction here. So why doesn't somebody really tell look this younger generation in the face and promise them that they're going to provide them with a livable future and make the choices that are necessary to make that future possible?
Well, I think you're right that we have to look to the president to do that, and he has indicated that that's his intention. Now, it hasn't quite happened yet. I am among a whole bunch of scientists who are eager to see the president take a form, an out front leadership role. And frankly, I don't think the bill passes Senate unless Obama gets directly involved and plays such a role. So I hope that he's calibrated this in some way, and that it's, you know, maybe he's playing it like an election campaign. Nobody pays attention during the summer, but when he comes back after Labor Day, he's going to go full throttle and really explain to the American people why this just has to be done and why it's big and why we have to do it now. So I'm with you on that. Obama either is going to do it or the whole thing's going to not work.
And if it doesn't work, then the rest of the world aren't going to join this regime.
Absolutely. No one, not only will the sort of malingerers among the developed countries like Australia and Canada and Japan, who promise big and do little, not only will they not act, but the Europeans that have been trying hard to cut their emissions will probably back off because their companies are going to say, why should we be paying the freight and suffering competitive disadvantage? And there's no doubt that India, China, Indonesia, Brazil, they're not going to lift a finger unless we act. So the U.S. has to not only act, but has to be in the leadership globally to make this work. And Obama is the guy to make that happen.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles and filling us in on this, where we stand on this huge issue. As I say, I take it very personally because I frankly, I don't know that we can really assure the younger generations that, as stewards of this planet, that we're going to hand them something that's viable.
Yeah, well, you're right. Listen, I have kids. My kids are 19 and 11, and I look at them and I say, we better solve this. So it's not a matter of, the people don't have different opinions about that. The differences are over, or what's the best way, and is this bill a pragmatic way forward? From my point of view, and I've been working this problem for almost 30 years on both the science and the political end, this bill is the best opportunity to get us started seriously in solving this problem.
Well, thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Michael Oppenheimer.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Michael Oppenheimer, who is a professor of geoscience and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at the Department of Geosciences at Princeton University. He's also the director of the program in science, technology, and environmental policy, STEP, at Princeton University. I'd like to thank Alan Minsky and Louis Vandenberg, the producers for today's show, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.